You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Yesterday morning, in an interview with the BBC, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix seemed to suggest that the U.S. exaggerated some of its evidence against Saddam Hussein and his regime to make its case at the UN Security Council for an invasion of Iraq. After the interview, he held a press conference.
That there were shortcomings is clear, and that refers not only to the intelligence from the U.S. side, but from around the world. And I need hardly repeat the concrete examples of that. And there is the Yellow Cake contract, which we have talked about. There is the question about the aluminum tubes. And there is also further the fact that out of the many sites that were given to us by intelligence and which we visited, only in a few instances did we find anything and nothing related to weapons of mass destruction. Now, I have not criticized intelligence for this. I have simply said that it's difficult, and the results that have come out have therefore not had its shortcomings.
Many on the Security Council argue that UN verification of the destruction of weapons of mass destruction would add a measure of credibility and help the U.S. win international support for the prompt lifting of economic sanctions against Iraq. The international community is divided over what must take place before removing sanctions. France would like to see sanctions suspended and eventually phased out, but not without UN involvement. And Russia argues that sanctions should only be lifted once Iraq is declared weapons-free, a feat which many experts say can be expected to take several months. Some members of the global community worry that the inspection process may not work with the UN weapons inspectors replaced by a U.S.-led inspection team. Again, Dr. Blix.
I have not the slightest reason to doubt that. But at the same time, I'm also convinced that the world and the Security Council, which have dealt with this issue for over 10 years, that they would like to have inspection and verification which bear the imprint of that independence and of some institution that is authorized by the whole international community.
Chief UN Weapons Inspector Dr. Hans Blix speaking at the United Nations yesterday morning. While Hans Blix speaks out against what he calls the U.S. role in undermining the United Nations weapons inspections process, he has also come under some criticism from the anti-war movement for not speaking out earlier when his voice could have had an effect on stopping or postponing the war. But Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Washington-based Institute for Policy Studies, says that Blix's silence was understandable, and the real task now is how to move forward.
One would have wished that Hans Blix was much clearer earlier. The fact that he wasn't is not surprising, given the level of control that the U.S. was exerting and the level of pressure it was putting on everybody in and around the U.N. I think what is important now is, one, to prove through a credible source, which is not the U.S. military team but is the U.N. team, prove through a credible source that the U.S. claims of its earlier justification for this war were simply not legitimate, that there was no danger of weapons of mass destruction being used. There probably were not even significant strategically available weapons of mass destruction at all. And I think it's important that that be proven. Further, I think it is important that even if the U.S. government's position is weapons of mass destruction are no longer an issue as long as Saddam Hussein isn't in power, this was always their position. They wanted to maintain sanctions until there was, quote, regime change, regardless of Iraqi compliance with inspections and with issues around weapons of mass destruction. I think we should be taking a very different position that says disarmament of all weapons of mass destruction is important. We should finish that with Iraq, and we should move regionally, as is called for in Article 14 of Resolution 687, that says that the disarming of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction should be a step towards the broader creation throughout the Middle East region of a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction and the missiles to deliver them. That means going after Israel's nuclear arsenal and any others in the region. Right now, the United States is the occupying power in Iraq, and as such, under the Geneva Conventions, it has an obligation to provide for the civilian needs. That means all of the emergency needs, food, clean water, electrical power, safety on the streets, and it means beginning the reconstruction work as well out of U.S. funds. The question of longer term, of course, Iraq's own money should be dealt with by the Iraqis, however they choose to use it. Sanctions should be immediately delinked from this issue of weapons of mass destruction. And I think that it is very important that sanctions be lifted, but they must be lifted in a way that takes into account the real problem with sanctions. Lifting the sanctions must mean that there is no longer 25% of the money from Iraqi oil diverted to the UN's compensation fund. It must ensure that there's real transparency in how the money is being used, particularly in this interim period. It must be based on a UN resolution, of course, and that resolution must take into account an arrangement so that the money will actually go to Iraqis, not simply to a U.S. viceroy in Baghdad.
Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies.
With Hans Blix at the helm. With Hans Blix. Blix. Blix.
Generals gathered in their masses.
With Hans Blix at the helm. Blix.
Camp Commando.
Blix.
This is a UN operation, remember.
Blix. Hans Blix.
The U.S. military now installing a new command center at a heavily guarded
Blitz. Blitz.
In the fields of bodies burning.
Listen to me.
I think one of the keys here, Bob, is that we get access to scientists and officials. Remember, we can interview scientists anytime, any place, anyone.
The wait is over.
We have the authority to take them out of the country and their families, to intimidate them. Unfortunately, scientists and their families have met an untimely death when they returned to Iraq, but we need access to these scientists and their families.
Blix, we do have stories now that we have officials for Saddam hiding things in their homes.
Daddy.
And now there are rumors that ordinary Iraqis could be hiding key weapons parts.
There's nuclear bombs in the fridge.
Ray. And chemical bombs.
Dad.
Could you keep it? I'm trying to do this thing for the radio.
There's nukes in the fridge.
Put that thing down.
You can put your eye out with that.
Don't
thing.
Touch that.
Kids drag in the darndest things.
There's anthrax in the peanut butter.
Stop playing with your food.
In their homes.
Today, kids are bringing home Iraqis.
Where is your chemical weapon store?
What's this, Daddy?
Kaboom dissolves rust stains.
These Iraqis are driving me crazy.
That's for ethnic cleansing.
Even this black buildup.
They want your oil.
Even if they've been there a while.
What can I do?
Use Kaboom to maintain your store.
Wow Chemical has the answer.
Kaboom is amazing.
Iraqi Go.
Give me some falafel.
Is it hard to use?
Just point and spray.
It's right before your eyes.
No more Iraqi.
Cool.
And my floor is so shiny.
Where's my Iraqi?
And you'll never see that build up again.
Call to order Kaboom. As a special TV offer, you'll receive
turn
two
down
30
the television.
People are hiding things in houses and schools and other places.
What's this button do?
Don't touch that.
Father McKenzie. Is there a scud in your pocket?
Well, you're a curious young lad. Come on over here to Father.
Call now.
Iraqi Go by the makers of Atheist Motel.
I remember my son when he heard the B-52 over his head. I put my hand on his heart, and I felt his heart bumping like crazy.
Bye.
danger through the song. All I see. Song is over.
That collage was produced by the radio satire group, the Christmas Coup Comedy Players, at Pacifica Stations KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. As the war in Iraq winds down, callers to Dr. Pamela Brewer's radio show Mind Talk on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington spoke recently about their feelings of anger and frustration over the war. They got suggestions on how to positively channel these emotions and how to cope in an environment that is often hostile towards peacemakers. Dr. Brewer starts off by reading a letter from a listener.
In my household, we are against the war and are very vocal about it. My husband and I share our feelings with their children and allow them to share their views with us. We respect their feelings and encourage them to voice theirs. Our community, however, is pro-war and pro the president. So, our children will express one view in our house, but will act and say something different outside the house.
My husband and I are in the same circumstance, exactly, perhaps more difficult in that we're both also in uniform. And what those parents need to make sure of is, one, that their children understand the dilemma, the situation, why we feel, why we are against it, you know, the reasons why. And then that in some cases, it's better not to say anything than to go along with the crowd.
What are their ages?
17, 15, 13, and going on 10.
They've got two parents in uniform.
Right.
So it gets to be really complicated for them. In your home, you are opposed.
Yes.
But outside of your home, you have to maintain a level of silence about that.
That is correct.
Okay. You know, it's really such a complicated picture, certainly for you and your partner, but then for your children as well, trying to teach them about the importance of their own voice and their own freedoms, at the same time helping them to see that free is not always free.
Exactly. And they've actually gone a couple times with other friends to demonstrations, and they've expressed themselves, and we support that. We can't be the ones who take them to it, or we jeopardize our lives.
Your lives.
Our livelihoods.
Okay.
You know, these are the careers we have chosen.
Right.
And the administration comes and goes. Our duty is to our fellow, you know, soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I think Americans need to understand is, please don't confuse patriotism, supporting our troops, and the president. Those are all very separate things.
Okay.
And one can be
good
patriotic
point.
By standing up against a war that is not just.
You know, there are those who think that anger is the thing that drives war. And there are others who think that actually at the point that you get to war, it's not so much anger that's operating, but it's what you feel as though you need to do to win. So then you're not focused on anger. You're on angry feelings. You're focused on winning. Now, there are wars that we fight every day, not on the grand scale that we are experiencing now, but you tell me, what do you think about the issue of anger?
I'm a 50-year-old woman who's really spent the first 20 years of her life in a very abusive relationship, not physically abusive, but in other ways, and really revolving around anger. And my partner was getting counseling for anger, you know, took medications to control his anger, but really never got a handle on it. So we are really good friends now. We're separated and we're pursuing a divorce. But the reason why I bring that up is the role that anger has played in my life has been abusive from childhood on. And I've always had trouble expressing anger, really even initially recognizing that I felt it. I turned it inward, and that, you know, resulted in depression and all kinds of, you know, immune system dysfunctions and so forth. But with this war, I have such moral outrage. For the first time, I'm really experiencing rage, and my voice wavers because I am so angry at what this country is doing. And it feels good. It feels good. It's motivated me. Two, even though I'm disabled, I've participated in marches.
Wonderful.
I've, you know, attended vigils, and I'm listening. I'm tuned in. I was a child of the late 60s uh-huh. and 70s, and even though I participated in those demonstrations and that feeling, I really didn't understand the situation as I do now. I didn't think that anger could ever be a positive experience, mm-hmm. and I suppose if I wasn't able to do something with the anger that I feel towards our current administration, that I don't know what kind of a place I'd be in.
One of the keys as we think about anger is exactly what this last caller just said. You want to do something with the anger. If you sit with it, then it gets kind of harmful, and all it does is to hurt you. What she has been able to do is to turn the anger into some empowering action, and that's part of what needs to happen with anger. Let's go to the phone line and take our next caller. Roger, how are you?
Good. I've never really been an angry person, but ever since this war started, I've just been really outraged at what's been going on, and I think it's been showing up in the way that I deal with other people, in the sense that I'm more angry to people that I've never really been angry to, like family and friends and so on. So it's it's interesting how it's affected how it's affected me and a lot of other people I know in that way. It's just every time I hear somebody talking about it in support of it or releasing hateful things about about the people over there, it's really heart crushing. But still, it seems like a lost cause to talk about it, just because nothing seems to be nobody. There doesn't really seem to be a listening ear.
Although, if you don't talk about it, I mean, I'm listening, and the people who are listening to this program are listening to you. And one of the values of using your voice is just that you get to use your voice and honor and by acknowledging your views in the world.
I'm a pretty logical person, but when things like this happen that I see absolutely no logic for, it just gets to a point where I can't function properly anymore. I can't, go to work and concentrate on things because my mind is somewhere else the whole time, thinking about these absurd circumstances and the things that are going on in the world that are, there's absolutely no basis for it, and about how there are all these lies in the media. It's all propaganda on both sides, but you can't turn on the TV and watch anything without or look at any. I mean, in any context, the war is being brought up. It's not even a matter of watching the news or TV. It's in any context.
It's everywhere. And, one of the things that I really tend to recommend when folks are dealing with traumatic pictures is that at some point you really don't need to see it over and over again. So if you haven't already done so, as much as you can limit the pictures and the news. That doesn't mean that you should be uninformed, but you also don't need to take a bath in all of the pictures of bombings and violence. And that's a way to help you feel better. And quite frankly, I think that listening to Pacifica Network, you hear more voices much like yours, and it begins to build a sense of community that perhaps you haven't had in the past. That's a good thing.
Psychiatrist Dr. Pamela Brewer speaking with callers about the emotional impact of the war on Mind Talk on Pacifica's WPFW station in Washington, D.C. The attacks in the U.S. on September the 11th gave rise to the birth of a new kind of military strategy, the global war on terror. From now on, there are likely to be far more conflicts where overwhelming military powers like the U.S. or Israel fight against small groups of rebels or, quote, terrorists, unquote. The battlefield is increasingly likely to take place where non-combatant populations live and work, and more civilians will be caught in the crossfire. While the suffering of victims of war is always tragic, there's also increasing evidence of the devastating psychological impact of those who do the fighting. One study of U.S. soldiers who fought in Vietnam revealed that 1 in 3 combatants experienced the psychological symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Typically, they would suffer emotional numbness and detachment from those around them, a state punctuated by intense flashbacks and nightmares in which terrible suppressed memories would flood their senses. Other symptoms are irritability and sudden anger, and many turn to drink or drugs to numb their pain. Many soldiers are able eventually to deal with their experiences and return to a normal life, but they can still be weighed down by their past. Independent reporter Arthur Neslin recently spoke to 2 young Israeli soldiers in a Tel Aviv cafe who are involved in a new and painful struggle with their own memories.
I remember one Saturday that I went into a village with a few of my soldiers, and kids started throwing stones at us.
Guy Grossman was 19 years old when he entered a West Bank village as part of a normal patrol, but his actions there still haunt him today, 11 years later.
I started chasing them. They ran away. We shot a bullet in the sky to warn them. They kept on running, and me and my soldiers shot escaping kids in the lower part of their body. We shot a 7-year-old boy in his knee. We surely crippled for life.
One tragic irony of war is that the perpetrators of violence often suffer from similar traumatic reactions to those of their victims. Of course, the guilt of a soldier for the pain he has inflicted can't be compared to the torment of an innocent Palestinian who may carry the physical and mental scars for the rest of his life. Yet trauma experts say that they may have this much in common. If the incident was stressful or life-threatening enough, both victim and perpetrator may have repressed overwhelming emotions at the time of the incident as part of a survival instinct. Guy says that at first his actions did not disturb him.
There was no trouble after the event. You are so caught up with the logic of the occupation. The day after you go into another village, the day after you go into another village, the day after you go into another village. Reality is so awkward that it almost seems natural.
And so when it did begin to trouble you, when the memories came back, how did you deal with it? What were they like?
I don't think that it came up as memories, that I was forcing them up.
Well, in fact, if you could go today to the West Bank to meet the child you crippled, what would you say to them?
I would tell him two things. One, I would apologize for shooting him. And the second thing, I would urge him to do whatever he can to stop the terrorists among his people, to make it possible for me to convince my people to withdraw from the occupied territories as quick as possible.
You know, however bad Guy feels about it, actually, he has to live with the consequences that he's, in many respects, ruined a great deal of that child's life.
Caroline Garland is the head of the trauma unit at London's Tavistock Clinic, and she's got extensive experience in dealing with the human damage that conflicts leave in their wake. She explains how soldiers have to build up an unshakable belief in the righteousness of their cause.
He's probably created an enemy of Israel for life. So I think it's whistling in the dark to say, go and tell your people to stop being terrorists and then we'll withdraw from the occupied territories. And that is always the situation in a war. You know, the sense of who's got the right on their side, who's got the moral upper hand. It goes backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And it always boils down to, if you stop, if you say you're sorry, then we'll stop too.
Sammy, an Israeli soldier who served in Gaza, was keenly aware of this contrast between feeling utterly convinced of the rightness of his cause or else morally bereft. He came to believe that Palestinians were looking at him like Jews in a concentration camp. He says he often felt that he was evil, and yet consciously he could only see evil in those around him.
As a medic, I had to try to save one unfortunate Israeli. His car, by mistake, went into Ofia, and they killed him, of course, in 2 minutes. And after this, there were moments that I found myself crying. I hated the Palestinians. So they were the evil by essence.
He does what all soldiers have to do, first of all, if they are going to fight. They have to get into a kind of paranoid state in which all evil, all wrongdoing is in the enemy, and they themselves are on the side of right and justice.
But what happens when soldiers who believe they are right commit unjust acts? Sammy describes an incident where he arrested a boy who had been protesting at the humiliation of his father by Israeli soldiers.
And he started to shout at him, "With what right you are shouting at an Israeli officer?" And took him to my vehicle. And if this is the side of the vehicle, took his face and very gently put it like that.
into the windscreen of the car?
Yes. So, yeah.
At this time, Sammy says he suffered from nightmares and irritability. He would cry or explode for no apparent reason. All common symptoms among trauma survivors, according to Caroline Garland. She says that because Sammy and Guy have begun the process of facing up to their guilt, neither of them seems still to be suffering from what clinical psychologists call post-traumatic stress disorder. Even so, she was uncomfortable with Sammy's description here.
It was the one moment at which I felt uneasy, because he was almost playing with the memory at that moment. You know, he did it nicely, gently, and so on. But the fact is, you cannot push someone's face without doing it violently.
Perhaps it's the memory of an incident like this that has led Sammy to now experience painful emotions whenever he sees news on television from the occupied territories.
Sometimes it makes me crazy. Not crazy, you know, just inside. Sometimes very desperate, helpless. This is a period that I think of as the most terrible period of my life.
As more and more young soldiers are sent to fight amid hostile civilian populations, the psychological reactions experienced by Guy and Sammy are likely to become more common. It's happening now.
I was watching in the middle of the night last night some of the scenes in Basra, and it was very striking to me how relieved the young soldiers look as they saw some of the population, including children, waving and smiling at them, so they could feel like liberators rather than like murdering monsters. And we all have to live with the knowledge of the bad things we've done. If you're a soldier and you've killed people, you've probably got more than most of us have to live with.
Guy and Sammy dealt with this knowledge by deciding to join the 1,000 or so refuseniks who won't serve in the occupied territories. But as Guy points out, the consequences of having served in a conflict can long outlive the conflict itself.
I remember looking back at the situation that when I was there, I was able to tell myself, well, we acted according to military regulations, we warned them, we shot a few bullets in the sky, we aimed at the lower part of the body. We were covered by the military regulations. It took me time to understand that it's not about military regulation. I left a 6-7-year-old boy crippled for life just because he threw stones at my Jeep.
That report was from Arthur Neslin in Tel Aviv.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. And he's soldiered for 1,000 years. He's fighting for Britain and he's fighting for Iraq. He's fighting for the USA. He's fighting for the Russians and he's fighting for Japan. And he thinks we'll put an end to war this way.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, OneWorldRadio.net, and Benta Berklin. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So please pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. We leave you today with Chumbawamba's version of The Universal Soldier. Thank you for listening. Without him, Caesar would have